irmãs, irmãs amigas e irmãs aqui, para dizer que estamos juntos. Diz a Diga Rum, a Diga Rum, eu não sei. Minha gente mora comigo. This week, it appears a lot of issues that are making headlines that people media come to our meeting for very useful headlines. This one is about the fiscal state of our country. It's always useful to understand the path of our country. So let's our agenda for this meeting has been circulated. I think members will have the main business of our meeting today, the presentation by the FFC on 2015-60 submission on division of revenue. Members will note that at the time when the minister presented MTV, DS, NSE, the process of preparing for the budget for the next financial year started, and then we'll always be looking into what are proposals, recommendations, to what extent that they affect us, what is the fiscal state of in the country. The first thing is to welcome members, and secondly, to also congratulate the FFC for successfully hosting the 20th anniversary conference here in Cape Town, which was a very broad, all-encompassing conference. I'm still reading some of the perspectives that are arising from the conference, and we will also use the documents there because very well researched documentation that will serve as a reference from time to time in our discussion. One important note that was made at that conference was that our fiscal relation is evolving, and the more our country's democracy is maturing, so will be the debate around to what extent or how we structure the fiscal environment in our country. So it was quite a very useful conference, and congratulations for convening such a successful conference. This is a sentiment of the committee, and many who attended the conference were quite very happy about the quality of the conference. Now, I see that the National Treasurer is here also, Wendy is here, and welcome Wendy and the team. Oh, are you by yourself today? Okay. Wendy and the National Treasurer team. So let's I don't know whether there are apologies just to all members of the committee. No apologies. Okay. Yeah, the member that is will arrive late, then is muted. As a standing apology of the honorable member from KZN, I indicated previously that he's in a very state of health. So she still excused from parliamentary work. So we'll have an indication. EFF is not here. Okay. EFF is not here. No EFF, member of the NCOT, not NA. Composition of committees is not by voluntary all the time. We have to be a member of another house, qualified to be a member. But we like the spirit of EFF members who are here today. You must come closer. You are welcome. From NA. Thank you very much. Let's proceed and then allowing FFC, the chair of the FFC, Bongani, to take through the presentation. Welcome, Mr. Chendeni. We're asking where you are today, and we're happy that EFF is joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the kind words about the conference. I think we also would like to thank the committee and the chairperson for the support that most of you I would say the whole conference actually, which was quite encouraging in terms of from our own perspectives. For today's process, I am accompanied by Commissioner Nico Steitler here next to me on my left, Dr. Ramos Mabubu, who is our research director, and Ms. Sasha Peters, who is our program manager for national budget. And then at the back, I've got Alex and Ali. They're also working in our Cape Town office. Mr. Exton told me that he's going to fetch some copies of the submission itself. Apparently some members did not get copies of the submission, so I think he's just coming with them. Hopefully, we'll be able to understand where we are going. We'll try to make it as simple as possible. As you have indicated, Chairperson, this is part and parcel of the 2015 budget process. This is the Commission submission was made in May, end of May, in terms of Section 2141 of the Constitution, Section 9 of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, and Section 44C of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure Related Matters Act of 2009. Now, the overarching theme of this submission is about balancing fiscal sustainability with socio-economic impact. And I think what is important to take from this submission is really around the state of the economy, where we are at now, the macroeconomic environment, and that the first set of issues that we address basically relate to the macroeconomic and fiscal frameworks for inclusive growth. One of the biggest challenges that we find ourselves with is actually being trapped in a low growth path. Which basically is no longer consistent with the expectations on our social programs. And therefore, we need to actually start thinking about how those expectations that are on the social program side, which sometimes manifest themselves in quite violent protests and all of that, and how do we balance that with the fiscus, which is not growing as fast as we would like, because the economy is not actually growing as fast as we would like. So we need to be able to balance that. Now, if your fiscus is not growing and your demand for public services, especially on the social programs, is increasing with high unemployment rates, it basically means that the fiscus comes under pressure. Your borrowing requirement also increases. Now, what is very key is how you then deal with the issue of the borrowing that you enter into. How do you spend that money that you are actually borrowing? So what we are saying here is that we must be careful as we borrow, because the growth rate in our debt over the past 5 years has been quite dramatic. We are not saying that the absolute debt levels that we have now are bad. What we are saying is that over the past 5 years, our debt has been growing at a rapid rate, and we need to be able to arrest that trend so that we can also look at what it has actually brought. I think there's a story that we've been talking about for quite some time now, which is around consumption expenditure and investment expenditure balance, striking a balance on what you spend. Let's say, for example, in your salaries and other consumption types of expenditures that do not yield well compared to how much you spend on infrastructure, for example, that creates the room for growth that will be also inherited by the future generation. So it's a very key discussion that we are bringing in that first set of issues there. Now, I think one thing that we must say is that when the global recession struck about 5-6 years ago now, if not 7 years ago, one of the issues that we brought to Parliament was that depending on the recovery of the global economy, South Africa's own recovery would not happen until around about 2015, and that was a scenario that we presented and said this is the worst case scenario. So the global economy has been very slow to recover, and the South African economy, because of its own exposure and also lack of robustness in terms of responding to external shocks, has actually been badly hit by that crisis. So we actually realized the low growth trap and the low recovery scenario, that out of the three scenarios that we had presented, I think it must have been in 2008 or 2009. Basically, that story is what we are now finding ourselves dealing with. And I think if I can recall also at that point, we spoke about pushing quite rapidly the infrastructure investment to rebuild the economy and using it to actually boost the potential for economic growth. But at the same time, we also dealt with the issue of cushioning the vulnerable of our society from the impact of that. So it was easier at that particular point in time because we were coming from positions of surplus. So there was a little bit of money. Public expenditure could grow at pretty much very high rates compared to what the rest of the world was already experiencing. So what we have seen in the past few years is that there's been a slowdown in public expenditure growth. In fact, going forward, we have already now seen the introduction of expenditure ceilings. And that is a very important development in terms of trying to manage the interplay between the demands and the fiscal and therefore the public debt. So there's a story that Dr. Mabugu will enunciate on when he makes his presentation. The second set of issues relates to improving investments in education and health. And these are very big social programs. So if I link that to the first set of issues, I'm saying we have so much money in the system. How are we utilizing that money? What value are we generating? So if you look at the issue around the equitable resourcing of schools, and I must say that, Chairperson, if you'll allow me, I have actually sent the response from the Department of Basic Education to that set of issues coming out and the recommendations coming out of that equitable resourcing of schools. So the Department of Basic Education has responded quite positively to the recommendations that have been made. The second one there that we deal with relates to healthcare. Healthcare is also quite an important part of the public social programs, and part of the reasons why we looked at the adequacy and efficiency of funding in primary healthcare was that the previous Minister of Finance actually made a request for us to actually look at that. So there are issues that actually arise there that would require attention as we go into 2015. And then there's a set of issues that's pretty new in the work of the Commission that relates to expenditure on food security. I think food security is actually a key component of the social programs in this country. But even though it's a constitutional right, in terms of Chapter 2 of the Constitution, the assignment of the function in terms of which sphere of government is responsible for what is not very clear. So there's a lot of programs around that basically maybe municipalities run with, that national departments run with, and also that provinces run with. We all have a bearing on the food security situation of the country. So we're trying to look at the resources that the country is actually setting aside for that particular purpose and the progressive realization of that right. So there are issues that are coming out from there. And then the next set of issues that we look at is investment in infrastructure, and that basically the primary focus is in the local government sphere. We are all aware that municipalities, in terms of basic services, infrastructure play a very critical role. But we are also aware of the challenges that bedevil the local government sphere in terms of underspending on new infrastructure and also underspending on maintenance and existing infrastructure and refurbishment. So there is a focus on the impact of prices, electricity prices on municipalities. What happens when Eskom and the electricity regulator agree on tariffs is not necessarily the same thing that happens with municipalities in terms of their own tariffs and what the regulator would then say in terms of the municipality. So we tend to worry about individuals and companies. We forget that municipalities also are a consumer of electricity and they must pay for it from Eskom. And then there are some challenges that have been identified around that particular issue that we will be talking about. And the final set of issues is quite important. It relates to the impact of demarcations on the sustainability of municipalities. What has actually happened is that partly we had already started the process with the demarcation board, looking at how they factor in those decisions, how they factor in issues around municipal fiscal sustainability. I mean, the demarcation process is not just about the finances of municipalities. There's quite a number of other issues that have to be looked at. So municipal finances are just about an issue that comes in, but how you then deal with it in the short term and in the medium term is actually quite an important part of the game that should actually be incorporated in some of the decisions that are taken when demarcations are agreed upon. Now, what we had was a case, a very specific case from the city of Tshwane, which related to the demarcation that happened a few years ago and the impact on the city. Just for interest, the city of Tshwane sent us a letter which basically indicated that as a result of the demarcation, redemarcation or redetermination of the boundaries, the city went to the red or had liabilities of over 1.4, almost 1.4 billion, resulting from its absorption of the municipalities that it had to absorb during the demarcation process. Now, in terms of compensation, out of the what 1.4 billion that they talked about, they were compensated to the level of 20 million rands. That does not go anywhere in terms of addressing the challenge. So we looked at it, but I'm not going to make judgments about the figure of 1.4 billion, but when we looked at it, it was probably on the high side as well. So, but you have to look at it in the context of the principle. And what we then come out with is we decided to do an assessment of a number of municipalities and what happened at the previous redetermination of these boundaries. And what we found was that invariably, in almost all the situations, municipalities were worse off. So there are transitional costs that municipalities have to deal with, over which they have no control as a result of the demarcation process. So we are making certain recommendations around the introduction of a conditional grant, a transitional measure. So that grant cannot be viewed as a permanent grant. It's just to assist with the transition of the municipality and restructure its own budget. So there are certain things that need to be covered. Let me, Chairperson, with your permission at this point, allow for Dr. Ramos Mabugu to speak a bit more on the first two issues, and then now Sasha and finally Professor Steitler will talk to the issues around the demarcation. I mean, some of you would know that he used to be in the demarcation court, so he's most qualified to talk about these things. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Morning, honorable members. I will take you through part one and part two of the submission, but make it in forms of conversations rather than reading through the submission. Now, for the first chapter in the submission, it doesn't make any recommendation. If the use value is to paint the picture that we see going into the next 3 years. So it sketches a chapter that is based on our understanding of how the country evolved in the past 20 years, and on the basis of that, where we are likely to be in the next 3 years. And it rises us from the National Development, a plan which puts fiscal policy at the center in generating economic growth and development, where development is understood to be not just economic growth, but one that has inclusiveness inside it. Now, the chapter, as I said, sketches from 1994 during the Reconstruction and Development Program all the way to 2011 when we are at the National Development Plan phase. And the big macroeconomic story around economic growth, employment and investment is that we now currently find ourselves trapped in some vicious cycle of modest economic growth rates coupled with record unemployment levels and extremely high inequality that has remained stubbornly high despite an extensive social program. Now, the aftermath of all this and the response that we saw to the global economic crisis that set in 2007 abroad and started to be felt 2008-09 South Africa was that the country responded by doing what is referred to as countercyclical fiscal policy. And that, to demystify that term, it just means government responds in the opposite way to how the economy is performing. So if the economy is subdued, government responds by expanding. If the economy is growing, government expands by shrinking itself. That's all that counter-cyclical stands it talks to. It's referred to as counter in the sense that government expenditure growth is opposite to what the economy is growing. So because we've been subdued in terms of economic growth since 2008-09, government has expanded its expenditure growth levels to mount the counter-cyclical stance. But what we have noticed is that as a result of that policy stance, and because it has now run for quite a long time, unlike before when counter-cyclical stance would just be for a short period of time, is that there have been unintended consequences on the growth in public debt to GDP ratio, rising from as little as 23% around 2008 to an expected 40% in 2013, which is quite a sudden jump in the direction of public debt. Now, when one looks at both kinds of debt levels of 40% of gross domestic product, by international standards, these are minuscule numbers, extremely small. But what is of concern from the Commission perspective is the direction that it has taken. That not in many areas you see it almost double in the space of 5 years. So that's the issue that we think members should be concerned with, not the level of public debt to GDP ratio. In terms of that, we can debate all day on what the appropriate level should be. But what is of concern is the direction that the public debt is gone and the speed with which it has suddenly jumped up. The implications of all those are, of course, that your interest burden is the one that takes a big flat, because the interest cost to service the growth in public debt is where you see some crowding out social expenditures or infrastructure expenditures from the mounting debt level. Now, concluding that chapter, our assessment of the 20 years is that there has been much progress in terms of reducing poverty and addressing inequality issues, and indeed overall management of the macroeconomy has been successful. But despite those successes in the three broad areas of prudent economic management, the addressing of the social inequalities, we still have various long-term investment challenges that talk to the need for investing in more mid-level skills, because we see that in a lot of areas, unemployment is really driven by that middle belly, mid-level skills that is missing from the system despite high levels of expenditure in education. Then on the physical infrastructure, there are issues around building adequate infrastructure, particularly in transport and energy, that are beginning to act as a bottleneck on generating economic growth. Then the final one is the big one of them all, without which it's difficult to maintain stability or indeed peace across not just in South Africa but across the world, where despite the low economic growth rate that we have seen, we continuously see that the distribution of the fruits of economic growth more widely have not been realized. In other words, inequality, unemployment and poverty remain stubbornly high despite the picture that we see on 20 years of relatively modest economic growth. It says we need something to do with distribution of those fruits that does not work. It's around those three key areas. Now coming to chapter 2, the first substantive chapter in terms of recommendations, it comes back to the issue of public debt challenges and the need for fiscal reforms. And the key argument that the chapter makes is that if our debt must not explode over time, then there is a need to respond forcefully to the conditions that in our tax base, not the tax base of before 2008, but the current tax base South Africa has been experiencing, and to the cost of finance, which is captured in the interest cost of the public debt. So those two levers for the forthcoming medium and budget policy statement are two issues that I think the committee should really take a keen eye on around responses to tax base and the cost of finance. Moving on, Sasha. Again, the main issue is that current debt requirements, spending on interest payments, begin to write your expenditure arrangements. And if one looks at certainly the past 5 years, your interest rates have been lowest that they've been in recent memory of world interest rates. So if one wants to be explain about it, the only way they can go is upwards. So the era of low interest rates is unlikely to persist forever. So there is likely every chance that interest rates are going to start going up, certainly towards more normal levels as compared to the past 5 years when we had the lowest interest rate regime in the period of recent memories. So we tackle this issue and try to explore various ways in which public debt could be moderated and come up with three sets of recommendations. The first one, again informed by that Cathy now has a definite plan, 2030, encompassing the National Development Plan, is that the country should actually not consider setting a target for the size of the public debt, given where public debt levels are. We think this will be self-defeating. Borrowing is still a valid and appropriate option that is available to government to finance ongoing infrastructure and development requirements, as long as they are consistent with realizing aspirations in the National Development Plan. And that presumes that debt management will continue with the objective of funding at the lowest possible cost within a given risk tolerance. The danger of going to a public debt target when you are sitting on 40% level of gross domestic product is that chances are you are going to recommend a level somewhere around 75-80% of gross domestic product. And the Commission doesn't think this is the way it should be going about it. Rather than worrying about the size of public debt, we should be worrying about what it is buying for the country, because we are sitting on relatively lower public debt levels at this stage. So the intervention should be more worry about what we buy with the space that we have in public debt sphere. And the second one says the whole exercise should not just be about simply cutting costs, but instead be used as an opportunity to reform a program and service delivery where those that have not been performing are either reformed or completely deprioritized in the system. And those that are doing more are actually expanded in the system. So the whole strategic focus need not be about doing haircuts, but rather looking and disentangling all spending and service delivery level programs and identify the ones that are yielding value and de-emphasizing those that are a drain, throwing money down the drain. So those are the two essential thrusts of the recommendations. The third one is a corollary and calls on government to avoid across-board cuts or indeed going for expenditure ceilings, because with expenditure ceilings you treat every program in exactly the same way, and this is not an appropriate way of going about it, as we show in the third chapter. The third chapter looks at one of the central tools for addressing social social ills around poverty and inequality. And these are the social programs which are a big element of the expenditure space. And the main issue that we want to discuss with the committee around social programs is the fundamental point that in the behest of wanting to consolidate budgets or control expenditures, very often you actually lose one of the most potent instruments that the country has nurtured over the 20 years. And social programs do indeed fit the bill in terms of social programs that the country should celebrate after 20 years of democracy. It's one area where there has actually been noticeable and quantifiable gains in terms of making an impact on poverty and inequality. But often when you hear discussions around consolidation, this is one of the easiest areas to target and look for making reforms, where you get arguments based on anecdotal evidence such as that they only encourage our young girls to have babies, or they promote laziness, etc. All that is pretty much anecdotal evidence which doesn't actually stand up to the evidence that we have on the ground about the impact that these programs are in. So the message behind Chapter 3 is in fact that when you are doing this across the board expenditure program arrangement, be very careful to keep some of the elements that have been working extremely well and the potential to actually grow the economy while being inclusive. And this is one of them. We run a simulation for the next 3 years, for the next slide, especially that actually show that in terms of economic growth, if you were to do a natural experiment that removes a social grant program, you will be worse off in terms of a gross domestic product by a full 1% of GDP if you were to wake up and remove completely the dismantle of the grant system as it is. And that is the most natural experiment you can do to counter or to get an answer to whether social grant system is what is called in terms of economic impact. It contributes an extra 1% GDP every year after all is said and done when one is taken into consideration both the supply and demand side of the program. And there are not many programs that have such a high return on investment when you rank them according to the impact on gross domestic product. Most programs will be way below 0.5% contribution to gross domestic product, and this is rather on the high side of return on a government expenditure and investment. So we make three recommendations to actually more aggressively make the benefit system more integrated, reduce areas of potential fraud where officials actually choose to circumvent the system by not applying the conditions that they should check, e.g. birth certificates, whether children are going to school, whether somebody that doesn't have an ID book is getting the grant. All those are human elements, not to do with the system, but that people are not applying their minds on. So we call for tightening all those areas around eligibility criteria, but not get carried away into dismantling or throwing away the whole system, because it does yield those positive returns on the economy. And the last one says all the relevant information necessary should be collected, because we couldn't find some of the relevant information for evaluating a fully integrated benefits system. That information should be collected and characterized by age, gender, so that more analysis can be carried guiding future policy around this area. Now moving to part two on improving investments in education. The first one continues with the social expenditure mode. And where this chapter takes us in terms of the message behind the chapter is in fact that where one is most likely to make a difference in terms of the basic education schooling system is when your focus is more on the poorest of the poor schools rather than spending a lot of your oversight time on mid to rich type basic schools. So one needs to really focus their efforts on these poorest of poor areas, poor of the poorest schools, because you are likely to make a huge impact onto the outcome in the education system. Our key findings, three of them, are that indeed there is variation and disparities in allocation of resources and performance of schools. The general perception that there is inadequate funding to fulfill curriculum requirements was confirmed in the chapter, particularly for poor districts. And there is a dissociation between resources and outcomes, particularly in poor schools. So again, when you're doing oversight, if you just focus on these extremely poor schools, the kickback or returns are going to be extremely high. There are six sets of recommendations which, as the chairperson said, the National Department of Basic Education is quite favorable too in terms of its response for next year's division of revenue that members may want to look into informing opinions around the MTVPS and as well as the 2015 division of revenue. The first one talks to aligning learner subsidy allocations with national policy requirements and priorities, and the department felt that alignment had been eroded consistently since the onset of the global economic crisis when they had to cut to do more prioritization. The second one says the allocation framework for schools should take into account the full package of the minimum education inputs when they are deriving the minimum adequate benchmark funding per learner. And again, the Department of Basic Education was favorable to that recommendation. The third one talks to infrastructure issues, particularly in poor schools, and it says the allocation framework for education infrastructure conditional grants needs to clearly set out expenditure targets for 1 to 3 schools and timelines for addressing the priority infrastructure backlogs in each of the quintiles. Fourth recommendation is that school funding norms and standards should indicate responsibilities between the schools and the provincial education departments for maintaining and upgrading school infrastructure, so that the division of expenditure responsibilities is very clear. Currently, the area is not very clear on where the responsibilities for provincial education departments and that of the schools lie around this area. The fifth recommendation talks to improving performance and monitoring, and the fifth one, it requests that the National Department of Education integrates the existing outcome improvement programs so as to improve basic education outcomes. Now moving to chapter 6, it deals with issues around adequacy and efficiency in primary healthcare financing. And the origins of this chapter is that in 2011, the then Minister of Finance came to the Financial and Fiscal Commission annual general meeting. And as part of his address to the Commission, he asked whether the Commission could look into whether primary healthcare was adequately funded or not. So we've spent the 2 years since 2011 looking at that particular issue. And what the chapter finds in terms of key messages is that, in fact, despite increases in growth in health spending that has been witnessed of late, the sector continues to be beleaguered by the most basic of problems, such as suboptimal quality of care, inefficiencies in the system, heavy burden of disease, input cost pressures, and a growing number of uninsured population. And last week we were in Free State, and this issue of a growing number of uninsured population is actually becoming quite a nationwide type problem, where for the particular case of the Free State, the issue that they discussed with us was that although they are a poorer province, their levels of insured population tend to be higher than in bigger provinces, and as a result, when one does the sharing, the equitable sharing of resources, they feel that something is not working extremely well with the system. They will, together with our colleagues in National Treasury, will look a lot more at the claim around quality of the data which is going into equitable share. But we do find across the board that these problems affect the system as a whole. As a result, it becomes very difficult to argue whether it's a true issue of adequacy and efficiency in primary health care financing, or whether it's a case of wastage or inefficiencies that are driving problems in the sector. So the recommendations that we make are two for primary health care. The first one is based on what we're able to establish, and this is around primary health care. But government needs to increase the allocation levels for primary health care funding so that they are at least in line with the minimum known standards for primary health care package that the National Department of Health has set. In particular, around clinic services, such as the integrated management of childhood diseases, reproductive health, and HIV and AIDS. The current allocation levels are definitely below the levels required by set the norms and standards. Then the second recommendation talks to the inefficiencies in the system. The issues of wasteful and irregular expenditure in the health sector need to be minimized so that at the very minimum they are in line with the international experience. And in this case, we recommend a way of reporting on wasteful expenditure to give it more meaning to anybody exercising oversight in the sector. And we say there should be three areas of wastage, each of them leading to different kinds of interventions that an oversight body can implement. First is to split that into clinical waste through measures such as clinical performance measures, which promote efficient use of resources. The second one is reporting on operational weight, and the final one is reporting on behavioral weight. And each one of those three leads to very different interventions. It is the intervention and oversight body will recommend if the waste is behavioral, it's very different from when it's just clinical waste. So we recommend that more and more government moves more towards providing this finer information. Now coming to chapter 6, it again comes to an issue related to the social expenditure, but this time focusing on fiscal expenditure and food security. And the argument behind the chapter is that you can spend as much as you want on basic education and health, but if people have no food in the summer, all those expenditures will come to a waste. So if people are food insecure, you can spend as much as you want on basic education and health, and you will not get back the gains that you are expecting. But again, since 2008-09, the global economic crisis, we have seen that there has been a definite hit on purchasing power of households. Households' purchasing power has been eroded, and as a result, that has led to impacting on the food security status of many households across the country. Then the chapter also finds that coordination problems do exist, partly contributing towards underperformance of the agriculture conditional funds. And in terms of our recommendations, they speak to these two areas that the chapter flags. The first is for us to strengthen its ability to enforce conditions in the current framework and ensure better oversight of provinces, for the spending and performance of agricultural conditional plans improves. And here we suggest that some norms and standards be developed assess the performance of provincial of the provinces in this area. And that's the evaluation of the conditional plans being institutionalized. And that is currently not the situation. So a simple management recommendation to improve the system that we currently have is the first recommendation. The second one is to put special focus on improving operations of different food security programs, and a number of these ranging from funded public work programs, school nutrition programs, so that they are more focused towards increasing household food security. The third one is that government should clarify the legislative mandate and responsibility of municipalities in relation to food security. Municipalities is the core face of food security, but their legislative mandate is extremely unclear on what role they should be playing in this particular sphere, and we think that's an area which should be clarified. And the final one is really a management recommendation around certain terms of reference for a committee to review the agricultural conditional plans without further delays into that process. Thank you, Chair.
That seamless swap, Sasha, you can continue the presentation. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning again to members of the committee and other colleagues. I'll take you through the highlights of our recommendations on related to infrastructure investment at the local government level. We focus on four aspects. Firstly, we look at those factors that hamper greater investment of municipal own revenue into infrastructure investment. Then we zone into some specific sectors, namely transport, energy, and housing. So Chapter 7 looks at that broader issue of why municipalities are not contributing a lot of own revenue into infrastructure investment. And that is the focus of that chapter. The reason we conducted this research was because in 2011 and 2012, we hosted public hearings on the key challenges that beset our local government fiscal framework. And what came out there was that there's a vertical between the spheres as well as a horizontal gap in the funding of capital of infrastructure. So that was the rationale behind conducting this research. We made four key recommendations based on this research. Firstly, what we found, and we've probably started seeing that, is that there's a definite trend of underspending of municipal capital budget. And the period we looked at was 2003 up until 2010. And that trend of underspending is very pronounced in that period. Poor spending is largely the result of poor planning, and this is also what makes us worse, is the lack of planners and engineers within municipalities. Bearing in mind the fact that Section 154 of the Constitution enjoins our national and provincial spheres of government to capacitate and assist municipalities with the carrying out of their mandate, what we recommended is that the monitoring and evaluation of municipal capital planning and spending needs to be improved, and that responsibility of the lies of national and provincial treasuries, and they should improve monitoring and evaluation of capital planning and spending during the municipal benchmarking exercises. What we also found is that due to the poor economic climate, municipal owned resources are under stress, and what we see is that municipalities have limited ability to generate surpluses from user charges and therefore to reinvest into capital expenditure. So what we recommend is that municipalities look to alternative and innovative methods to fund and deliver infrastructure. And here we recommend looking into the use of PPPs, private-public partnerships, or the option of outsourcing municipal services. What we found when we looked a bit deeper into the current environment with respect to PPPs is that there is not a lot of existing information on the use of PPPs, the challenges that are encountered. We also noted that there are various bottlenecks, red tape in terms of municipalities being able to utilize this tool. So what we recommend is that the PPP unit within the National Treasury improves monitoring and evaluation of the use of municipal PPPs. And then finally, with respect to this issue, whereas your urban municipalities may be able to make use of more innovative, more non-traditional revenue sources, your poorer, more rural municipalities, their options are limited. So we recommend that government explore new funding and infrastructure delivery model for these poorly resourced and rural municipalities. Okay, so going into the specific sectors that we looked at, the starting point for this particular piece of research was that there's a critical gap between the requirements of the National Transport Policy on one hand and the Public Transport Subsidy Framework and implementation on the other. So the chapter reviews current transport subsidy system with a view to recommending a more appropriate subsidy structure. We made four recommendations. Firstly, the National Land Transport Act is very clear on the types of transport plans that should be formulated and guide the different spheres of government with respect to transport. And the local government, that is the municipal integrated transport plan. Now, generally, what we found is that these plans don't have auditable planning targets. More importantly, municipalities don't use their transport network ownership to implement integrated transport systems. So what we recommend is that these municipal integrated transport plans must clearly indicate how the municipality intends to exercise control over its network. Moving on to the next set of recommendations, Chapter 9 looks at the issue of administered prices, specifically with respect to the electricity sector. Municipalities are constitutionally assigned the responsibility for distributing electricity. So they buy bulk electricity from ESCOM and resell it to end users, households, businesses, etc. Now, the price at which they buy from ESCOM is regulated. And then the price at which they resell is also regulated. So what we did was to conduct some research on how all of this affects the revenue and expenditure of municipalities, because income from electricity sales is a key source of revenue for municipalities. And what we found is that the increases in these prices negatively affect both the expenditure and the revenue. So what we recommend is that government put in place a plan to manage the risks to municipalities associated with increases, specifically in the price of bulk electricity purchases. If you consider the plans underway to improve environmental sustainability, such as the pending implementation of the carbon tax, the cost of complying with such regulations will be passed on either from ESCOM to end users or by municipalities to end users. So that makes the crafting of such a plan all the more important. We also looked in Chapter 10 on the focus on the issue of housing demand, which is critical in providing for future housing needs. In that chapter, we had a secondary focus on identifying key constraints and levers for self-built housing. And the reason for this focus is that the government encouraged households that are able to contribute to their own housing needs to participate in self-built initiatives to free up resources, you know, for the most vulnerable groups. So the recommendations there, what we first did was to distinguish poor households that are able to use the self-built option and poor households that need subsidy housing free of charge. And what we found in our study is that the subsidy eligible households most likely to succeed with respect to self-built construction option are those with a housing replacement value of between 2,500 and 8,000 and 8,020,000. Now, households with a value of under 2,500 will require subsidy housing from government free of charge. So these are generally your households comprised of the most vulnerable groups, your female-led households, containing children under the age of 20 years, for example. So our recommendation is that the housing subsidy prioritizes these groups, and that target and indicators be put in place and monitored annually to track whether our subsidies are going to those vulnerable groups. If I can hand over to a commissioner just to provide a bit of clarity in our last bit of recommendation.
Thank you, honourable members. Just then briefly, the long session here is the demarcation, and as the chairperson said, I was previously 10 years at the demarcation board, and the drive for many of these changes and redeterminations and amalgamation was precisely economic reasons. The unviability of some municipalities, the duplication of district and locals, where there's only two, the local municipality for a district. So it was driven by good economic sense. But the in-depth analysis of what the actual cost of such mergers were not always fully appreciated. And the case that came from Tswane was a very instructive one, which showed the real costs in terms of what happens when there's a merger in terms of tariffs, in terms of pensions, in terms of salaries, in terms of bylaws, etc., etc. So, and that these costs have never been, or not always been, incorporated in the research that the MDB does. So I think a very valuable report was produced with some very clear recommendations that you go into DORA. And one should now recognize that the decisions made last year on certain amalgamation, particularly in KZN, where there's a number of mergers there. There's also a merger in Gauteng, and also declaration of a new metro, which is under court, under litigation, is that these new demarcations will come in 2016 with the new with the next local government election, and then in preparation that there should be a restructuring or amalgamation grant, which is set out what should go into it, and it is really detailed, and then done in a 3-year cycle, a year before the amalgamation, particularly the preparation. There's a huge amount of preparation done. How are you actually going to do it? Then in the year of the actual establishment of new municipality, and then obviously the year thereafter for the consolidation period. So that was a hard recommendation that we've made to Treasury. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think there's no need for me to make any other contributing remarks. That's the submission.
Thanks very much for the submission. I think it's appropriate to say that, just to remind us, the Deputy Minister of Finance, during the presentation, his presentation at conference, made a very important remark that FNC's recommendations, I think Deputy Minister Jonas, that FNC recommendations contribute to qualitative debates in terms of what choices we make and so forth. I think make that very appreciated, because I like what during the presentation it was highlighted also that some requests made by Ministry of Finance on what FFC must look at, particularly provide research, useful recommendations, and then enhances government in terms of the debate. I think when this year, normally there used to be very useful conversation, FFC National Treasury, in issues that we need to take decision on. I'm saying this because I think we should appreciate that with strong institutions, particularly institutions that governments have been created through the existence of our constitution. We need very strong institutions that contribute to the development path that the country is taking. So members, you will realize this is a very useful material to reread, I think, again, and to engage with some of the issues. As I said earlier, at a time when the Treasury presents MTB as October, the indication is also spelled out what likely government is likely to take and so forth. And in NS, it's a very useful process. Now, we can raise questions out of the presentation. What are the questions? I do have a couple of questions. If you don't have questions, you might need in the chair to speak on your behalf. Okay. Yes, sure.
Your person starting with
Helen.
Starting with the last input by the professor, I think it's crucial that the Select Committee on Appropriations meet with the Demarcation Board regarding the impact financially on demarcation. It was never done in the past. We have to do things a bit differently. secondly, on the issue of food security. Food security program was rolled out 2004, if I remember correctly. And it was given to the Department of Agriculture at that stage. There's a conditional grant for it as well. But chairperson, when you move in towns, in communities, you don't see vegetable gardens because that is what it's actually supposed to be. And I speak now from my own province. And even now, it's not done in the correct way. And we're now 2014, now 10 years. We can't every year speak about the same thing. Then we would have to put a mechanism in place to do extreme monitoring and call, in this case, NCs to task. Because there's not a shortage of money. The money is there. It's about implementation. The same with regard to education. As issues referred to here, the first contact between a school and the department is a circuit manager, Afrikaans springbestuurder. We have to relook the duty sheet of a circuit manager. Go to school, sit in the principal's office, complete a form, get into the car and drive back to Springbok. Finish and club. Email the report to the provincial office in my province, Kimberley. Mm-mm, that's not good enough. We've got experience in Limpopo. Excellent example. Helsinki might not be that. It is now corrected. So that's my proposal to Chavas, that we also rethink the method we are applying to address the issues. Because the FFC is coming up year by year with the recommendations. The minister replied to this in the documentation that will be tabled in the national budget. What about the other select committees and the other portfolio committees' inputs on this document, because they're all implicated, it's not only us, as finance and appropriations. Thank you, Chair.
Charles,
I just need clarity on the local government, where you talk of your recommending to put it. Now, as far as I know, Triple P feel that the community does not benefit much in it. And here we're talking of radical changes where we want to transfer the economy to those who are disadvantaged. And Triple P has not worked. It's worked in the first world and seen it in Australia and all that. But do you see that would work here? Will it create jobs? If you can just clear me on that one. As far as agriculture is concerned, I agree with your recommendation there. Because basically that the nation is just dumping money to the provinces, not being monitored. So I really agree with your recommendation on this one. But just clear me on this one here, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, until then.
Thanks, Chef. Let me first appreciate the presentations. These people, they seem to know what they are actually doing. Because, comparatively speaking, if we check the amount of work they have done, and the way this was actually imparted to us, I think it carries a lot of weight, and well done for the job. I just want to check a few things here, whereby what makes me happy is because at the end of every presentation, you seem to be coming up with a solution. And when I check most of the time, I just want to know if you normally get involved with, because you see with most of these committees, there are, you know, somewhere in the government where we do not even lend a helping hand as portfolio committees or select committees, whereby you find that there are only executive power that take decisions. And I just want to check on the issue of where you indicate that at one stage we were found to have reached a ceiling in terms of borrowing. Our country seems to be borrowing too much. And I want to understand the logic why, because sometimes you'll hear the president has assisted the country so and so with so many billions. I want to understand the logic where the president is with his own executive powers. We borrow from other countries, and at the same time we're giving out. I want to understand the logic thereof. And number two, this conditional grant, whereby you assist the municipalities, I want to know if you might have taken your part in as far as redetermination of boundaries is concerned, as we are in a run-up to 2016 local government elections. We have had the demarcation board being blamed in many times. Like, I may give an example of other municipalities. You find that other municipalities do not deserve, you know, the municipality status. But just because of an influence of an individual who happens to be there, and he does not want this area to fall under Area X, you find that it affects the whole country. So I just want to know, as a government entity yourself, are you able to come did you sometimes meet in meetings with the demarcation board where you give corrections to say this is wrong, this is right? Because some are seem to be much more adamant as far as this intention of boundaries is concerned. I have quite a few questions here. I also would like to know, I was taking some notes as you were doing some presentations here. You indicated some of the policies since we have been into this democracy for the past 20 years, they don't seem to be, they are a little bit shaky. They don't seem to be stated in terms of economic growth, if I understood you very well.
So I just want to, because I was watching the news last night on TV, the GDP results are going to be announced today. I know it already could be a concern to know what exactly in this country it could be. Because it is, when you check from 2008 to date, we've been fluctuating a little bit. So I just want to make sure that if you already have received the results as to where are we today in terms of this GDP thing. Or should we wait for the news late at night today? Maybe other questions will come as you answer this one that we have put to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Njeni. So you say that this is very useful. Right?
Yeah.
As public policy maker, it's very useful presentation.
Mm.
So it's more of an economic management sciences.
Yes.
We're dealing with it improves our infrastructure economy.
Yeah.
Human talk economy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And allocation. Fiscal allocation. Whether or not we share the fruits in a balanced way, as is stated.
Okay. That's what the set of the first issues that has been asked, would you want to comment? No, that one point I just want to make a comment from the chat. I like this one of the wasteful expenditure. Three areas of wasteful expenditure that must be categorized. I think that's an issue that needs to be pursued fair. We really need to deal with this issue, because as I understand you say that there should be consequences. And that's an issue that we're grappling with. I don't think we can be routine life. We need to elevate, bring some innovation. So this used to be, this is a very good recommendation that is spelled out here. We need to find a way of how practical we bring it. Fortunately, National Treasury is here. When it will help us rethink as well on these matters in future, so that we deal with these issues decisively. Given the shrinking fiscal envelope, that they will not have much to play out. We need to really be much more tougher in how we direct the fiscal resources. Okay. Then there's an issue I'd like you to comment on. The issue of electricity and the regulator, NERSA. This principle of cross-subsidy, what is it? Yes, cross-subsidy. Yes, that principle. I sort of don't understand it. In Mangaung, there's a general complaint. People think that they're paying heavy on electricity in Bloemfontein. What could be, I don't know whether you have done any comparative study. Is it the variation in terms of prices and is it because some areas they could have been private manager on electricity or whatever? That's something that you may bring in a service provider maybe or what. Have you ever made any comparative loop in terms of this price, whether the price is realistic, for instance? But generally, I'm just taking an example. And you say that this is a very important revenue for municipalities. But as well, the issue of affordability of electricity and as a basic necessity, as a basic need, striking that balance. I just want to hear your comments on that issue. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, honorable members. I think a number of the issues raised were comments. I think Honorable De Beer, I'm not sure whether you would like me to respond. I think you were making comments about what do we need to do, and I think I really agree with you that there are certain things that must be done differently in terms of how we then exercise our oversight on some of these matters. Because if you're looking at issues of, you know, the value that you actually generate from expenditure or from the allocation that you approve, then you can only be able to do that if you actually can see the proof that things are actually happening. And that is where the issues around the efficiency in allocations and spending become important, especially with reference to your education and health allocations and expenditures. The issue of PPP, I think I will refer to Sasha, she will respond to that. The issues that were raised by Honorable Member Mtileni, Let me say, the commission, when we table our submission, we table it in Parliament, and what is generally tended to happen is that certain different portfolio committees have been able to follow up with us and invite us to come speak to them if there are issues of particular interest to the submission. But also we have, in terms of our own processes, direct relationship with the finance committees. And that basically, the process is that the finance committees and appropriations committees in both houses, we have to brief them on our, especially when it comes to the annual submission. There are other documents that we submit on an annual basis. So, for example, at the MTBPS point, we will submit a response of the commission that we will brief again these particular committees. And in February, we will respond to the budget, the fiscal framework, the appropriations bill, and the division of revenue bill. So we will respond to all of those, and again, we will brief these committees. So, with respect to our relationship with the other committees, it's really an expectation from our side that when they pick up, or as and when they pick up, that there's something relevant for them, then they can invite us to come and share our inputs with them. And of late, I mean, there has been an office that's been established called the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy in the Deputy Speaker's Office that arranges some of these meetings with those committees that are impacted upon by the submission when it's made. So we rely on Parliament for that. Now, the issue of, I'm not sure what the issue around borrowing and the savings, what your question of what I was hearing though was what you are saying is that it sounds like to be a contradiction in the sense that when we say our debt, the growth in our debt is a concern, but at the same time we must borrow, but then we must also lend other countries. Yeah, I think there's a process like in the budget process itself that basically caters for our relationships with countries that we have those ties with. So, you know, when you borrow, you're looking at, what we look at is borrowing in terms of the division of revenue process. Now, what is of concern for the FFC and its mandate is that the division of revenue is from a pool that the fiscus collects. Now, out of that pool, you must make provision for debt and for other national interest issues, which is where the issue that you're talking about comes in. So it's from the pool. You will make provision for that. So you literally topside something. Then once you have done that, then you will have a gap. You will have a gap that you must actually fill in. Because if you are going to have a cake which you cut, and then you start writing it. But all of these mandates, the program that are required, obviously they come less than what you have done. So if your debt requirement is actually growing as fast as we have been witnessing, then you must have an interest in knowing where is that actually going. And what we are saying to you is that it must be spent on productive investment. And so the questions that must be asked of the executive when you deal with this is, of this borrowing that you have incurred, let's say over the past year, or that you've been carrying over the FTF, how much of it is going where? Normally what they tend to do is they will present, National Treasury does present that, and ourselves also do present that when we deal with the budget. We do present what the different shares in the expenditure. So your compensation to employees, your investment. So you see a graph that basically tells you about the composition of expenditure and what is happening on a yearly basis, let's say over the MTF. So that is the story that we are talking about. So you have to look at a piece that deals with debt and say, what is the composition of the debt? Where are you spending it? Is it debt service? And if it's debt service, why is it growing so fast? That is the story. So I hope, because the things that we're talking about are on the expenditure side. You're trying to slow the rate of growth in public expenditure. We haven't reached a point where you are actually saying, let's cut public expenditure. Public expenditure has been growing at a very high rate, even though we had the challenge on the growth in the public revenue. But what we now trying to do is to arrest that requirement or borrowing requirement by slowing down the rate of growth in public expenditure. Now the ceilings have been imposed so that once you have made an allocation over the MCF, so even if you get more money, let's say the fiscal miraculously presents more money, you're not going to give people and say because you've got more money, yes, so you can expand your programs, okay? You just want to control that and retard or arrest the rate of cost in your borrowing requirement. On the issue of conditional grants, this relates to the MTP. Now, we have a relationship with the Municipal Demarcation Board, which we started, I think, about 2 years ago, through an MOU that we signed with them. So we have actually had quite some useful engagement with the Municipal Demarcation Board over the past 2 years. In fact, Dr. Ramos Mabubu here was part of the team that assisted the MTP in looking at some of the economic issues around this last round of demarcations or determinations or redeterminations of boundaries that have taken place. But obviously, this thing must go beyond just looking at those economic issues around the viability, because there's a difference between the economic viability and the fiscal viability. Because the fiscal viability is like on an annual basis, so your economy grows over a period of time, and the response is actually happening over a period. But every year, you must actually have a budget and you must spend money. So people don't wait for the economy to grow first so that they can actually say we want service delivery. And so you can't cut services because now you have inherited a poor municipality. So this thing relates to that particular process. That's what we were talking about. So those discussions do take place. I'm sure Professor Steiner will also come in and assist with that. Let me just ask Sasha to speak first on the PPPs and also the national subsidization issue. And then Khalid, you must respond on the food security comments. And then we'll come back to Prof. Steiner. Ramos will forgive you for today.
Maybe just dealing first with the chief question. There is no single tariff that's charged to end users. Each municipality determines what the tariff will be in with approval of NERSA. So the Systems Act provides guidelines on how your tariff should be structured. So you've got a base tariff, and the revenue emanating from that tariff must be used to reinvest in the sector. So with electricity, it must be used to reinvest into repairs, maintenance, operating expenses, etc. Now, municipalities can also charge a surcharge, which is a tax on top of a tariff, which can also make those tariffs higher. Now, technically speaking, according to the legislation, the revenue emanating from the surcharge component can be used for general expenditure. So it can be used for cross-subsidizing, delivery of services to households, but for other services, it's not electricity. So let me just be clear. Revenue from the tariff is for reinvestment in the sector. Revenue from the surcharge is to fund general expenditure. So anything else besides electricity. The problem is the practice that it's not very clear where the tariff ends and where the surcharge begins. So we can't strictly say this is what you should be spending on electricity and this is what you should be spending on cross-subsidization, for example. I don't know that answers your question. On the question about the PPPs, I think our recommendation recognizes the the potential drawbacks of the of utilizing PPPs, and this is why we say that we advise that the PPP union should assist in addressing those bottlenecks. You are correct that internationally, if there are benefits, we need to sort of tailor the use of PPPs to our particular context, and I think that's what our recommendation is driving.
Yes, just with regard to the question on the implementation of our agriculture conditional grants, in the study that we did, what we actually found was that the quite correctly, so there was a problem with regard to implementation in provinces. In fact, in terms of implementation, one of the key stumbling blocks was the issue of procurement. Promises would, for example, go out, get a service provider, but then down the line, project would come to a halt because service providers are unable to complete the project. What we also found was that there was a problem in terms of monitoring by national. So National Department of Forestry and Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries is not actually monitoring promises the way that they are supposed to. So you actually have a situation where promises, for example, submit reports, but the reports aren't properly interrogated, and National is not actually following up with regard to doing inspections and making sure that what they actually indicate in those reports are actually taking place on the ground. What we call for in the recommendations is actually a complete assessment of the value chain of the conditional ground to actually identify those bottlenecks and try and block some of those bottlenecks that we actually have.
Just to Prof, just before, because you responded on the issue as well of demarcation. On demarcation, there's one remark you make here that economic consideration is an important fact, but more often it's not taken on board when demarcation are made. What would be the case? Why is it lost in the process?
Just responding to that, the drivers for, say, amalgamation of municipalities, it's usually the provinces. They come and say, well, we want to amalgamate two municipalities. The one has got no own revenue. It's totally dependent, or largely 90% is dependent on transfers. So that you can, in fact, make economic gains and make it more viable if it's joined with one next door. So there is clearly economic circumstances that drives the process. Now, I think the failure of the MVB, and I'm not speaking on their behalf, but just like my experience, was actually now to say, well, okay, clearly there are going to be gains. There's gains, if there's a merger, there's one municipal manager rather than two, there will be a reduction in the number of councillors, etc., etc. But then what is the cost of joining the staff, the patients? Those costs were not separately, in my experience, costed. And here the MEB or the FSC studies, well, these are costs. And now one will have to come up with a weighing of the benefits that you're going to get by amalgamation, the savings, plus what then often is a transitional cost, which is not a permanent cost, but a transitional cost. And that's why a grant works on a transitional basis to get over the hump of the changes that's affected. So you will have to make a much more clearer assessment of what is the real economic benefits that is derived from a merger. And just on the question of, you know, is it just any individual who may influence MVP? Probably not. It is an independent body who must justify its decisions in open. It's a process, an open process, and if it's going to be challenged now, just say, well, on these and these reports, we made our decision. It's not going to be a whim and a fancy that it should serve me. He's not checked by the FSC. They can't come as a superior brother and say, hey, sorry, your decision is wrong. That not the case. There is various ways where there's objection process, and in those processes they should be clearly people coming to but your sums don't work up or don't add up. This is getting more costly, doesn't work. That's cool. Just the last just comments on the PPPs, and I'm not speaking as an FFC member, but just in my own work as working in the local government law, is simply overwriting of the requirements to do a PPP. There are so many costly requirements of, in fact, citizens of various consultation processes that in our encounter with the municipalities, they simply say it's too costly, it's not simply worth it. And if you want to do a PPP with a community organization to provide something in a community, you have to go through a PPP process. This is simply not quite. So basically, it's not a view that may be shared by the FFC, but my view was that it was so overwritten that it was written out of the law. Serious look at and really can correct me to see whether in business with in the PPP unit that they want to have created. Thanks.
Let me just, there was one question, Chairperson, that I did not answer. And it relates to, again, Honorable, you were asking about the GDP. This is what my boss, Dr. Ramos Mapuku, had given me. He's quick on this. It's actually an increase. It's a positive 0.6%. It's not massive, but it basically allows you to move away from what everybody was worried about, that I'm going into a recession. So it actually avoided that. So from a negative 0.4 to a positive 0.6, that's the outcome.
Well, thanks, RFC, Wendy, do you, yes, my comments?
Thank you very much. Just maybe to highlight how the process works, and the reason why I'm here is actually to listen today. And what is important is that what national government does, and I think it's important to stress that national government responds to the FFC recommendations and not the National Treasury. So what that requires us to do is to take all the recommendations that the FFC prepared and then to submit it then also to relevant departments or national departments to get the input. We also consult with provinces to get their input. And we also take it to political practices where we then take it to Budget Council, for example, where the Minister of Finance meets with the MECs. We only as government respond formally to the recommendations when we submit the budget. So we don't make any announcements during the MCPPS. I think that's quite important to note. And then maybe what we can also recommend for this committee, some of the proposals made, and I see it's already coming through, this presentation also opens the doors for committees to determine who else can they invite to actually deal with specific issues. And there was quite a bit of focus on agriculture, so it could maybe be useful also then to call the National Department of Agriculture, for example, to go through recommendations, for example.
Thank you very much, Wendy. Yes, thank you for yes, that's how we understand the process will unfold. So we will, as a committee, the committee will have a strategic planning session next week, and we'll have our workshop to deal with MTBS. What is MTBS? Yes, BPS, MTBPS. We'll have our workshop. That will straighten up some of the things, expectation, outline the process, and so forth. It's a very important one. And we know that the recommendations will culminate in number of fora, where the FFC will as well present or participate in the response of these, the response to the recommendations that the FFC has tabled. So it's an ongoing, very intense process that we need to treat it as a very important process. For instance, even now the submission as well helps when we deal with provinces as we go into provincial week. Unconditional grants, their performance, all of those things, it helps us. It's a source of information that is very useful and to look into the certain areas. And we also appreciate that
recommendation has been made in this meeting, captured. The Secretariat has captured the recommendation on the demarcation board, on who else can invite. I think the committee will entertain that, so that it invite a range of views. And we did agree as a committee at some point that we also must be, we must create a very open way of talking, conversation. So we must meet even outside this room, whether we dialogue, whether it's a round table, but we need to facilitate some kind of discussion, because issues that we deal with are quite important. So we want to thank the FFC for the presentation, and that it is useful. We'll continue to engage, and we will not hesitate to invite FFC to deal with other issues. We are quite aware that even the conference generated a lot of ideas. Along the way, there may be, we may need time to flag on some of the issues. The hallmark of successful countries has always been around long-term planning and the discipline of action, how you really implement your policy action and ensure that the desired results are cultivated. So thank you very much for the presentation. And you can excuse us. There's nothing left now with tea, so you can excuse us so that we conclude our business. thanks so much. No. But yeah, those ones we want to proceed with. Thanks. Members, I want to draw attention, because time now, at least we are left with 7 minutes before one, to allow you time after that. The minutes, I want to draw attention to the minutes of the previous meeting. The minutes of the previous meeting. Motara, you were absent, and Zondi, and Mr. Isaac. So that's the correct reflection. That was the period of Rama, what, Eid? Yeah, the period of Eid. Well, most of you were attended Eid festival on this day. Eid. Yeah. The eating festival. The Eid, not the Eid. I-D, yeah? E-I-D. Eid. Yeah. We'll spend. So, members, is it a correct record of our meeting? Yeah. Any mover? Shall I move Ms. Gaila? Second. Okay. Thanks. And then what else? Yeah. Secretary, I'll allow the secretary just to highlight what have I missed on our just projecting 2 weeks, 3 weeks to come. What is happening?
Okay, thank you, Secretary. Thanks for the opportunity. What is going to happen next now, as per the program of the committee, is that the committees, appropriation and finance, they will convene a planning session on the 2nd and the 3rd of September. But I think the approach is that all NPOP committees will convene in one place, and then there will be breakaway sessions for the committees to do their planning, the costing, and then I assume that thereafter there will be a kind of a plenary session wherein those programs, I mean those work plans will be presented. Yeah. Then after that we will have the MTBBS workshop. We intend to invite National Treasury, FFC, the Budget Office, and then it will be ourselves. National Treasury will explain to the committee like the kind of documents that the committee must expect when the Minister of Finance present the MTBS, and try and assist members how they will navigate around the document, because it will be short time. I mean, I think the local session starts at 9 o'clock until 2 o'clock when the house is. So during that time, members have to go through, maybe a member might decide to focus on his allocation for his province and all the stuff, or look at other on national issue, consumer grants and all the stuff. National Treasury will focus on that. FFCN as the advisor, they might try and sensitize the committee on which issues the members must look at and all the stuff, together with the budget office. Ourselves, our responsibility will be to explain the step by step what is that the committee will do after the tabling of the MTBS.
issue of creating provinces, the issue of receiving negotiating mandates, final mandates, public hearings, consideration of reports, and what kind of reports the committee will adopt, of which there are three. The first one will be on the division of revenue amendment bill, because I guess there will be amendments on the division of revenue. Second one will be on the adjustment provision bill. Even there, I guess there will be some amendments. And then the third report will be a report that will focus on the proposed division of revenue, which will also include the conditional grant process. That report is kind of outward looking. It will look on the next 2 years, the expected application in the next 3 years. Unlike the amendment on division of revenue, we will focus on the like current amendment. So that's all that I can say for now.
Thank you very much. Just a highlight for activities to come. Two members, I see the two hands, Delaney and Adem Rashupi.
I hear he has missed out on what has been suggested by Mr. Didier. That one of having the demarcation board. I don't know if we cannot be able to fit them in on that week because it is very crucial. They definitely have to come and do their own presentation. As well as the indicated.
The management will look at that. The management will process that.
Okay.
We take the recommendation need, but the management will process it. Because it is a program maybe for fourth quarter or so, but it's important. Is that them, Tarpi?
No, thanks so much, Obuchen. Mine is a very much revision from the platform that we had. Was that there was not much that was done by officials in terms of preparation for the threat plan. That is where we have a problem. You could realize that commission too. It must have really nothing to say. It actually has nothing to say. But it is because there is no framework. And it is then the work of the officials. There's a previous plan, I know. You don't bring issues to politicians. That is now they must go and trust. Come with a framework. To my whole work around it, and to look at it, and interrogate it, and begin to talk to it. From making a special plea to officials.
Thank you. The special plea is that officials for the appropriations and finance, please help us to generate some of the issues that we should not lose sight of for our strategic planning session. There are very critical issues that we need to put on the agenda. We always say from time to time also that let us make it a point that routine at hand kills. Let's really find a way to say we must check up our oversight function as these two committees. Because, we are going to conduct oversight as two committees. I'm a member of finance committee under the chairpersonship of Shah. So, let's really elevate issues. If we don't, and also we need to really make sure that we spend our budget appropriately, of the committee budget. If I don't spend, I'll have problem with my front desk here. This innovation of wasteful expenditure of clinical or it was behavioral, I'll check whether it was behavioral to Baba Arohe or Estelle and Sitao. And then, so it will go to finance. So that, if we can't spend 750 or whatever budget that we have, it means that we not understand our priorities with regard to oversight. So let's be clinical as this committee. So the challenge is, we need to be persuaded by our own staff. They need to put us on hold. So we must be able to do our work. But anyway, just to, if that issue is identified, plan, and then we do so within the framework that shall be regulated as we advise. Thank you very much for this meeting, members. It was quite a productive meeting. Thanks. We'll meet again in the city. Yeah, there's a city. That's planner.
Thank you.